Hi, everybody. Good evening. Welcome to the broadcast. This is Evoke Therapy Program's broadcast on what your children don't want you to know. It is November 12th, 2018, and we want to thank those of you who made a sacrifice to serve our country and family members for your service and for what you've done for us. So thank you very much. Tonight's broadcast is about learning what children really can't say. And when they do know it, it's hard for them to say because these are part of the things which in the short run can kind of help them if there's a power struggle or if there's a behavioral expectation. But in the long run, these are things that looking back on, they wouldn't want their parents to live by. And so I think a lot of times when we think about children and their manipulation, their behavior, even when we talk about it at Evoke, I think there's this mistake that we make that we talk about it like it's all conscious. And so tonight, I'm going to talk about things that are and are not conscious, and really the kind of what lies beneath the dynamics between parents and children in the process. So let's get right to it. First and foremost, the very first thing I learned when I became a wilderness therapist 23 years ago was how amazing the staff, the field guides were. I was amazed at their patience. I was amazed at their capacity to stay outside, live with these young people that were struggling, to offer their heart to them. Our research tells us that the field staff are identified by the students and clients at the top of the things that made the biggest difference to them in the program. So that's the first thing I noticed was these amazing people that worked with these students. But the second thing I noticed, and the first thing really about the clients that I worked with, was how resilient they were. How most of them came into the program saying, I couldn't, I can't, I won't be able to do this, but yet they were able to do it. They're able to do it, and they could adjust to different levels of structure, rules, time away from home and friends, and in many cases, most cases, even being prepared to go to an aftercare, some kind of residential school or program, was something that they could adjust to with grace and with strength. And so even in the early days and for years, children will come up with a very specific weakness, like it might be reading or writing. And we make sure that any learning differences are tested for, are looked out for, and understood. But the amazing thing is in many, many cases, students and clients would outperform anything that they had ever done before without accommodations. And so while your child might not be a reader, for example, to use a very simple example, you may find that at Evoke, he or she reads 2, 3, 4, or 5 books. They might not be accustomed to writing, might not write well in school or a lot in school. And at Evoke, they'll oftentimes begin to write and begin to write a lot. So they're much more resilient. Obviously, part of this, again, is it's not all conscious. They don't know it. But it's a hard thing for them to be accountable to, right? Their level of capacity. That they will forgive you for your mistakes. Parents ask often, what if my child doesn't forgive me for sending him or her to Evoke? And the point I always make is that healthy children forgive their parents even of their mistakes. And I'm not even assuming that Evoke is a mistake, but even if it were, just for the sake of discussion, children forgive their parents when they grow up and get healthy. And in the most extreme cases, when parents are abusive to children, part of growing up and healing as a human being is to let go and to forgive. And so they will forgive you for things that they don't like, for things that they don't agree with, and even if you make mistakes in parenting. And part of that is forgiving yourself. Part of that is not needing to be right and letting them be upset. Those are important and really essential to them learning to forgive. If you have an agenda, if you need to be forgiven, If you need them to get over it, they're much more likely to stay stuck and stagnate in non-forgiveness. They know your weaknesses and fears as an individual and a parent. One of the assignments that I would do with parents and children sometimes is have a parent and a child at the same time and exchange these letters, these assignments, where the parent would say, these are all the ways that I think you can manipulate me. These are all of my weaknesses. And I would ask the parent to give it to the child. And sometimes parents were anxious with that. Like, doesn't that identify? Doesn't that give them ammunition, so to speak? And my experience is with this and a lot of other things in therapy is if you name it, it doesn't have more power over you. It has less power. If it's conscious, if it's highlighted and underlined, then you can do battle with it, right? If it's a weakness. And oftentimes weaknesses are specifically things that you need to be seen as. So if you need to be seen as loving, that's normal, typical for a lot of parents, of course, or fair or just or patient or trusting or whatever it is, that is the thing that they will hold against you when they don't get their way. So again, like a lot of the work, it's about letting go, really embracing your imperfections, your humanness, knowing that even if you are a loving person, that you're still even going to have some limitations to that at times. You're going to lose your capacity and your patience to express and to show love. So it's critical that you do your own work, like I always talk about, in these areas, so that you essentially don't ask your children to take care of you, to buoy up your self-esteem. You've got to look in the mirror. You've got to go to a therapist, to a support group, to a supportive partner or peer, and kind of work it out there so that when you come to the child, you can be there to support them. Why doesn't mean why. This is true not just with the parent and the child relationship, but true in a lot of relationships. Why typically means when individuals are having any kind of emotionally charged conversation, why usually means I don't like it. And I want you to describe your version of why, your answer to the question why, so that I can give you a rebuttal. Rarely in these kind of emotionally charged discussions do you give a really reasonable answer to a why question, and a child responds with, you know, you've made some good points. I can see it from your perspective. Don't agree with you, but I can see it from your perspective, right? We know that that doesn't happen most of the time. It's an invitation into a debate. And really, it's just an invitation into who's right, whose feelings matter more. And so the antidote to answering the why question is just to say, it's my best guess. This is what I'm comfortable with. Maybe I'm willing to give you some reasoning behind it, but if you come back at me with a counterpoint, then I know you really didn't want to know why. You just wanted me to make my point so you could offer your counterpoint. Sometimes I'll just respond to why questions with individuals in my life and in practice and just say, I know it's hard. If I was you, I wouldn't like it either. And in that way, I'm kind of underscoring what the why question really means. They don't want you to take care of yourself. This helps in getting what they want. In other words, if you can imagine having, just imagine for the sake of discussion, kind of bulletproof armor in terms of your own self-esteem, self-image, self-worth, then anything they said about you would go right through you or right around you, would fall to the ground. But because we all have needs to be seen a certain way, to be a certain way, we spend our time, even with our children, at trying to prove to them that we are that way. So again, leaning into your weaknesses, leaning into your own darkness, your own faults and frailties, really changing it from I'm right to I'm me, are keys to this one. They don't want to take care of you, but they need you to take care of yourself. Similar to the previous one, but what I mean by that is if a child believes that he or she has to show up a certain way, even if that way could be argued to be a healthier way, but if they have to show up a certain way, if they have to feel a certain way for you to be okay, they're fundamentally being asked to take care of the parent, right? We've flipped the responsibility of who's taking care of who upside down. So they don't want to take care of you, and they need you to take care of yourself. For a lot of us, that's going to induce guilt. I was watching a broadcast today on parenting about this, where a father was talking about his guilt in parenting. And his response was, well, if I spend quality time with my children when I'm home, you know, after I'm working, maybe the guilt will go away. And my experience is the guilt needs to go away some other way. The guilt needs to go away because we've got to do battles with our own dragons and demons. And if a child needs, if a child knows at some unconscious level that you need to be thought of and felt about a certain way, they can pull the strings. I remember I had one very loving, very warm, very dedicated set of parents that I was working with. On top of that, there was a significant amount of anxiety, of course, too, but parents did their due diligence, visited the program, visited other groups, brought a sibling out, did everything they could, ask for updates the first few days because they were so anxious they thought maybe they'd made a mistake, asked for updates day after day. And after a few days, I just said, I'm not telling you have to trust us, but you either need to trust us at some point or you've got to pick up your son. So after a visit to the field, they could be comfortable. And so fast forward a few days, I'm reading the hopes and intentions letter with the student in the group. And one of his statements is, I don't think my parents, specifically my father, love me. And I said, if your father doesn't love you, I'm not sure any father does love his parents. And I'm not sure that there's any way that he could prove it. And I had a whole history, let alone the recent history since the child had been in our program. I had a whole history to look back on the things that the father did to try to love his child. But again, somewhere that child knew that that father, most likely because of unsorted out, undealt with childhood wounds of his own, needed to be seen by his son as loving. I said this in a tweet today. You cannot control whether or not somebody feels loved. But you can control whether or not you love them. And those are two very dramatically and importantly different things. The first one, for them to be feel loved, is most often about you having a peace of mind, and it's manipulative, and I've got to make you feel something. But loving you, supporting you, showing up for you, that's something I can do. And something someday that your children will recognize when the power struggle is gone. But younger children, I mean just gradually younger, the younger that they get, know what the parent's weakness is, know what the parent needs, know what the parent doesn't do for themselves, and unconsciously, maybe to the point of consciously, uses that to hold the parent hostage. I talked about this at the outset of the broadcast tonight. They aren't necessarily making their decisions intentionally. And I've had students say, especially after multiple treatments, I've had them say it after our treatment, well, I wasn't telling the truth, right? I just kind of BS'd my way through that. And for years, I wondered about that and thought it was true, especially when I was the second or the third treatment, and they were saying things like, now I'm telling the truth, but in previous treatments, I had just lied and manipulated. But then what I discovered through years of practice was they say that so that they can put forth the idea that when they are struggling, when they're not making healthy decisions, that it's purposeful. It's really hard for them to say, I was sincere, but it's a lot harder than I thought. I really felt the way that I felt, the way that I expressed myself in previous treatment or when I was at home, but temptation got the best of me. I regress because I'm not quite ready to stand on my own two feet without a lot of support. That's a harder thing to say. I've had a few say it, but it's rare and it's exceptional. They want you to think that you have to be right, right? They don't want you to stand in that place that I said earlier a few minutes ago where this is just how I feel, this is just what I'm comfortable with. Debating, the act of debating is winning. If they're in an argument with you, they're winning. I remember there was a poster up at a program where I started many years ago that said arguing with a teenager is like playing wrestling with a pig in the mud. The problem is that the pig enjoys it. And they might not enjoy it from the sense that it feels pleasurable to them, but it's a good distraction, and there's a possibility that they can wear you down. They can find eventually your Achilles heel. The second big theme tonight that I want to talk about is the connection between resiliency, right? Doing something hard, doing something that takes delay of gratification, frustration tolerance, grit, stick-to-itiveness, and self-esteem. They feel good about themselves. I'll borrow from a couple of places tonight and make reference. One is from the work of Dr. Carol Dweck. And she talked about the growth mindset. Originally, it was used in math settings. And what they tried to deal with was this idea that there were certain people that were math people, math brains, they called them. And then there were non-math brains. And that's really a culture that I grew up in, right? You were either good at math or you weren't good at math. But because of what we know about neuroplasticity and pruning and exercising the brain, we know that one can develop new capacities, new neural pathways. And they saw the people that were identified as math brains, they saw the stress that they were under. They saw the struggle with self-esteem that they were under. So they looked at all of this and they started to develop a curriculum. And basically the curriculum was they separated classes into two groups, math groups. In one class, they had so many hours of instruction per week. And in the second group, they had less math instructions. But what they did is they taught them about neurobiological development and functioning. And then taught them about how brains could grow and change, especially during adolescence, which is between 13 and 25 when we talk about brain science. So the only difference between these two groups was one spent all of their time doing math and one spent a lot of their time doing math, but spent some time with skits and exercises and education that taught about neurobiological development. Then they tested them. And what they found was those with the growth mindset, education, less math, did better in tests. That when we know that if we practice and stick to something, that we can get better at it, we tend to do that. When we think we either have it or we don't, we quit earlier, we cheat, we spend time trying to maintain that image of being the math brain, we quit when things get hard, we choose easier exercises, right? Because if your esteem is resting on, I'm a math person, I'm a math genius, then you spend time trying to maintain that image versus, you know, grit, working hard, not giving up is what really makes the difference. The only difference between the control group and the test group were two lessons, a total of 50 minutes, spent teaching not math, but a single idea that the brain is a muscle. Giving it a harder workout makes you smarter. That alone improved their math scores. From another source, sure, he's special. This is from Nurture Shock. But new research suggests that if you tell him that, you'll ruin him. It's a neurobiological fact. We praise effort. We praise grit. We praise patience. We praise things that they have control over. But to praise giftedness is to praise something that they don't have control over. And so all of those things that I described earlier come into play. Quitting, cheating, choosing easier tasks, changing even the subject matter. emphasizing effort gives the child a variable that they can control. They come to see themselves as in control of their success. Emphasizing natural intelligence takes it out of the child's control and provides no good recipe for responding to a failure. Dweck and others have found that frequently praised children get more competitive and more interested in tearing others down. Image maintenance becomes their primary concern. One father said Thomas didn't want to try things he wouldn't be successful at. Some things came very quickly to him, but when they didn't, he gave up almost immediately, concluding, "I'm not good at this." With no more than a glance, Thomas was dividing the world into two things, things he was naturally good at and things that he wasn't. So it's not something, I always say about this idea about praise, it's something that I wish that we were all taught. It's a very simple skill as a parent. And it's true, it's so obviously true that I wish it was given to us all for parent education. And so many parents that I work with over the years, and I've done this also, spend so much passion and energy trying to inject into their child some confidence, some esteem. And really what the child senses is anxiety. They sense that dad or mom worries that I don't feel good about myself or might even think that I'm less than. And so they're trying to create this contrived sense that I'm good, that I'm okay. Interestingly and importantly, I want to say this too. They've expanded the growth mindset to pro-social behaviors. When they teach children that their brains can develop in such a way that they can act more with more respect and in kindness toward others, children tend to score higher on tests and through other observations. So it works in many areas. This relationship between work and esteem, which I mentioned earlier, and we talk about wellness therapy efficacy. Efficacy is a sense that what I do makes a difference, that I and my effort are going to have a big impact on my satisfaction, my success. Thomas Edison said, "Opportunity is missed by most people because it is dressed in overalls and looks like work." And there's such a shift in our culture lately for recreation to be a substitute for hard work, right? Even some wellness therapy programs have become primarily recreational adventure therapy programs. They get in cars and vans and they go do fun things. And we know that there can be some nice team building, some nice feelings of satisfaction and fun, but it's not necessarily a healthy and helpful substitute for hard work. It's why NASA uses wilderness therapy to train its teams to build team and trust. So we have to be exposed to something difficult. We have to have problem solving, we have to have stress. All of that creates vulnerability and the opportunity. It's really the garden for trust and team building. Recreation works. We're tempted to do it because everybody's happy. Parents feel less stress, guilt, and personal discomfort. They protect against struggle and failure. And of course, the children aren't angry with them if they're providing recreational activities. I say in the first part of my book, I'm not completely opposed to some recreational activities as a part of it. We try to have fun every day in the field. But the big problem I have with adventure therapy as a model in our field is that many times it just sells to people, but it doesn't address some of the fundamental dynamics that are necessary in the parent and the parent-child relationship for to shift toward a more healthy pattern. And lastly, an important thing about really building resilience in your children is to see them. It took me a lot of years to understand what this means, to see its benefit, but seeing a child, understanding them, resonating with them, versus getting frustrated, being confused by them all the time, being upset and anxious by them all the time, gives them a sense, provides sort of an internal copy to them that they're okay. And to do this, we have to look past behaviors. We provide a container, which is a clinical term for holding space for them, being patient, curious, asking questions, believing. And you can have boundaries, but believing also that most of the problems that we call symptoms are the child trying to work out some trauma, some wound in him or her. I love the work of Jessica Benjamin. She said, she's an attachment theorist, she says it's almost impossible to find yourself until at least one other person finds you. What I say in my book is what you think about your children is how they will come to think about themselves. Your thoughts and feelings towards them will become their inner voice. Worrying about them and giving that to them and having them in that all the time sends the message, gets interpreted as something must be wrong with me. If the persons, the people who love me the most, my mom and dad, if I cause them a great deal of distress and worry, I must be broken. This is why we go and take care of our anxiety, stress, worry somewhere else. We let it inform us, but we show back up to the child without loading that on top of them. It's a practice, and it's not easy, especially for those of us parents who have children, and I'm one of them, who have struggled with some of these issues. They give us good reasons to worry. So therefore, we think we're just giving them the natural consequence of how they show up in the world. But it's still our job to go take care of ourselves, not theirs. They are not responsible for our serenity. When a person realizes he has been deeply hurt, this is from Carl Rogers, a great therapist. When a person realizes he has been deeply hurt, his eyes moisten. I think in some real sense, he is weeping for joy. It is as though he were saying a prayer. Thank you, God, that somebody hears me. Somebody knows what it's like to be me. Obviously, there are things that get in the way of us being able to do this, hold space for them, provide a container, allow them to struggle and fail, allow them to do some battle with esteem. Right? We have barriers that get in the way. It's not because we're stupid people or bad people, but it's our own wounds from childhood that we're trying to fix in our children. If we didn't feel heard, then we want to prove to our children that we are hearing beings, right? So we try to control how they feel towards us because we don't want to turn into our parents. Unresolved hurt and anger at our parents shows up in our parenting. Alice Miller says, it is as though we are trying to protect ourselves from something that already happened. We turn them into objects. Their success almost literally becomes our success. Their failure almost literally becomes our failure. All of us can relate to that. That struggle. That's some of the shame and the stigma that's out there in having a parent that struggles. Our fear and anxiety leads to anger and ultimately control, right? We want to protect, we want to control for outcomes. We over-identify with them. We struggle with our empathic misery and don't want them to struggle. Early in life, that makes a lot of sense. They're quite incapable creatures early on. As they grow, the idea is to allow them to struggle. And I always say this, that the worst sound in the world is not a baby crying. The worst sound in the world is my baby crying. Your baby crying is unpleasant. My baby crying is unthinkable. I tell the story in the beginning of my book of talking with a student after he had shared with me, we were sitting in the rain, it was drizzling, on a broken down fence, and he was sharing with me the sadness and the grief at the loss and the missing of his mother. And I became aware so profoundly that I had nothing to say. No look on the bright side, silver lining speech. And I just sat there crying with him. And I say in the book that therapists call this containing and parents call it impossible. It's one of the reasons why this kind of therapy works, why other people can do things that we can't do for ourselves as parents. That's true for me and for you. And then learning to value successes and failures. I've told the story a few times, but it was a great story I read about the CEO of Spanx, that underclothing company. And she was saying when she grew up, her father would ask at the dinner table every evening. You can Google this. He would ask at the dinner table every evening, where did you fail today? Tell me something you tried and failed at. And then somebody would tell a story and he would clap and applaud and say, congratulations, you were trying something hard. If you didn't have something you failed at, he would act just a little bit of disappointed. Sounds like it got to be kind of a game that they played, but he would say, well, maybe tomorrow you can try something difficult. Most of the valuable lessons that come to us come from our failures, comes from our struggles, come from our detours. It's really why we ask you to embrace this entire process as not a detour, but where you need to be, doing what you need to be doing. I say this sometimes, if I were a higher power, I'm not, sometimes I think I am, but if I were a higher power, I would give you, your children, to teach you what you needed to know with their particular struggles. In fact, it's my experience that they're kind of designed perfectly to teach you the specific lessons that you need to learn to grow in life. Right? This whole process is about transformation. So valuing the successes and the struggles, the failures, is a really important shift that I ask parents to make. We learn to listen. We develop what I call an adult and a parent filter, which means that we listen, but doesn't mean we have to respond and fix everything that we hear. But we have empathy, we have compassion. We understand the principles of praise, praising effort, praising things inside of their control, not giftedness, not potential, not talent, but rather the things that it takes to grow, to develop, the things inside of their control. A sense of self in a parent, right, doing their own work, will lead to a greater ability to see your child. The more grounded you are, the more aware of your own trauma background, your own wounds, your own triggers. And they don't have to be big T traumas, by the way. Just the stuff that happened to you. The more clear, explicit, overt that gets, the more capable you will be at seeing your child and responding to their needs. The value of hard work versus recreation. And coming to know your barriers, and specifically in terms of your wounds. All right. Happy to take any live questions. My son calls himself an addict, yet he still says he can smoke pot and drink. He's 19 years old. Besides the fact that they are both illegal, everything I've read, my Naranon group, other kids struggling, say it's all or nothing, especially earlier on. My son says each person recovery is individual, and so many can do some substances, but not others. Your thoughts, please. Thank you. I'll say it two different ways. I kind of side with you and the people that say, if you're an addict, and when they say that in Al-Anon and Naranon, what they mean is you can't use in moderation. That's the thought. But he's also right that it's his recovery, and everybody's recovery is different. That's also true. But really, the point here is it's not your job to figure out whether he's an addict or not. It's not. When they're over 18, your job is to say, I'm not willing to support the experiment anymore. More. Maybe you're not, maybe you are, but here's my boundary. Here's what I can have in my house. Here's what I can have in my life. You go figure it out. And it's really none of my business whether you're an addict or not. That's not my job. In fact, the core of my codependency tells me it is my job to figure out where you're an addict. But I'm not okay with it anymore. And I don't want to fund and support the experiment anymore. But you can do that somewhere else. So that's the most important shift, is learning, as you know, this is a slogan in Naranon and Al-Anon, knowing what your side of the street is and staying on it. And that doesn't mean being passive and having no boundaries. It just means being clear about your boundaries and self-care. And taking your head out of you figuring out whether he's an addict. He's got to sort that out. But you've got to sort out your boundaries. You speak to the idea that parents shouldn't show their kids that they are anxious. What is a safe way to show your child that we as parents are not anxious? If they are 24/7 flight risk, making the whole family stressed out or potentially could be harmful to themselves. You can say, I'm worried. You can say, I'm concerned. It's when we get repetitive, when we show up very anxious. You're allowed to say, I'm frustrated, I'm angry, I'm sad. But if the idea is you need to change your behavior so that I'm not frustrated, that's where it becomes a problem. And what that looks like is perseverating, repetition, getting loud, repeating yourself in different ways. That being your only approach is to tell them how you feel. So in the context of a boundary, you can say, I'm worried. You can say, I'm concerned. But if you come crying, wrinkled brow, wringing your hands, I'm so upset, it's the energy that you bring to it. It is okay to say, I'm worried and concerned, and I'm going to make a decision based on that. That's okay. But if sharing your feelings becomes your primary way of parenting, the primary intervention between you and your child, you're loading on top of them. And if you're coming with a lot of energy and repetition, that's loading it on top of them. So I hope that helps. All right, I'll go to upcoming announcements, and then if there are any more questions, you can enter them while I'm doing this. We ask all parents to attend 6 12-step support groups, some combination of Al-Anon, Code of Families Anonymous. You can also go to NAMI.org and find free classes, affordable classes and services in your community. Our podcasts are available on the podcast app or on an Android device. You can find them through the SoundCloud app, or you can go on a laptop or a desktop on the web and go to soundcloud.com. And in all of those cases, search evoketherapyprograms.com. On Twitter and Instagram, we're available at Evoke Therapy. On Facebook, you can find us at Evoke Therapy Programs. The Evoke Family Foundation is on Facebook. It's an organization of alumni families that have banded together to raise money and to support people who can't afford treatment. Our blog is always a source of new content. My book, The Journey of the Heroic Parent, is available on Amazon, audio purchase, digital purchase, and right now the warehouse is out, so you just go to the other options underneath the paperback tab and click on the new option and just buy it from Evoke Therapy Programs. It'll just be sent out from the warehouse there. Workshops coming up, Cascades. The next one is Cascades, December 8th through 9th. Some of you are already signed up. You can combine that with a visit to see your child. Contact Melanie at evoketherapy.com. We would like all parents possibly, all current families to go to this. If you want to do a deeper dive, the next intensive Finding You will be December 5th through 9th. You can also do a custom family intensive. This is in our lodge in Park City. This is not wilderness living. This is in our lodge in Park City where we help families and individuals to do really deep work into what's going on in their lives. I do one for myself every year. Parent support groups, I have some new ones to announce. New York City, well, if you're watching this broadcast live, you're not able to go to the New York parent support groups. It's tonight, 7 to 9 p.m. It's happening right now in New York City. I'll be in Philadelphia Wednesday of this week, November 14th from 7 to 9 p.m. I'm doing a public talk about resiliency in children. That will be at the Wayne Presbyterian Church in Wayne, Pennsylvania, outside of Philadelphia. That's Thursday, November 15th at 7 p.m. I will be in Parry Sound, Ontario, Canada, Friday, November 16th, and on Saturday the 17th for a 3-hour workshop with families at Parry Sound Public School. I'll be in the Bay Area December 11th and back in New York City on January 14th. Any information about any upcoming parent support group or speaking event around the country, email Melanie at evoketherapy.com. Go to our website or email Melanie. Pursuit trips are for families and young adults. Think sober fun, therapy light. Any live questions? Last question. My son is working on himself. We are working on our parenting. How will we ever know if we are able to live together? It's a great question. It's a hard one to answer. I guess the answer is it's like a lot of the decisions. It's not that you'll know without a doubt. You'll just be ready to try it. The difference in the sensibility of finding a self, of really the kind of therapy and parent education that we do here, It's not about being right and about knowing and about perfection. I often ask parents, how do you know 2 years from now if you made the right decision? And oftentimes parents will kind of give me this list of things that they'll be seeing. But really, the response is, I knew it was the right decision because I did it. I made the decision with the best information that I knew, and I kept my eyes and my ears open. And even if something happens that tells me we weren't ready and that the decision was premature, then we learn from that. And so my answer to the question is, you'll know when you're ready. Listen to professionals, listen to feedback, listen to education, get more aware of yourself so that you can have your best thinking. You're on this broadcast live. Read the literature, do the assignments, watch other webinars, listen to other podcasts so that you have the best information possible. But the answer is, you'll know when you're ready to try it. And it's okay, depending upon the age, it's okay if it doesn't happen. It's heartbreaking. I've been through it for good reasons and for not so happy reasons. But it's okay. Sometimes children later on in adolescence, young adulthood, sometimes they do best and families do best when they don't live together. All right, folks, no further questions. I am going to be off the week of Thanksgiving. So, and I'm going to be gone for the rest of this week. So the next broadcast will be Winter and the Holidays in the Wilderness. And that'll be Thursday, November 26th at 7 p.m. Mountain Time. In the meantime, look at our large library of webinar archives or podcasts, and you can catch up on those. I hope these webinars, these broadcasts, are helpful points of contact. Thank you for and in behalf of your children for showing up, for doing your work, for being open. Good luck, take care, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye. No time.